I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, Eye on Israel, how the White House is responding to recent criticism from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Religious exemption. A Catholic hospital in Canada is facing a lawsuit over its refusal to provide assisted suicide. We have the latest. The faithful in Africa. A church leader in Kenya takes us inside daily life and the role of the Catholic Church. And the true presence. Learn more about a recent study regarding the Eucharist and the United States. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Feast of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. Our top story tonight, the Biden administration wants to avoid a second front in the Middle East war. Israel is already battling against Hamas in Gaza, and now there are concerns its other fight against Hezbollah could lead to a devastating regional war. Things could be reaching a tipping point. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen?
Tracy, fighting has escalated in recent weeks, and that's raising fears the clashes could soon boil over into a full-blown war. And tonight, once again, the U.S. trying to ease tensions.
Smoke rises on the Gaza skyline. The fate of the proposed ceasefire deal there remains uncertain. Hamas still holding about 120 hostages. And in southern Lebanon, Israeli fighter jets strike a Hezbollah launch post. Hezbollah began attacking Israel almost immediately after the Israel-Hamas war erupted on October 7th. The U.S. State Department says it's extremely concerned and does not want to see escalation.
We have seen a dramatic increase in strikes by Hezbollah across the border targeting Israeli villages.
Earlier this week, Israel's army announced it has approved and validated plans for an offensive in Lebanon. And Hezbollah warned it has new weapons and intelligence capabilities that could help it target more critical positions deep inside Israel in case of an all-out war.
The best way to unlock the possibility of a resolution along the Israel-Lebanese border would be achieving a ceasefire in Gaza.
Israeli strikes have already killed more than 400 people in Lebanon, most of them Hezbollah, but also over 80 civilians. And in northern Israel, 16 soldiers and 11 civilians have been killed by strikes launched from Lebanon. Meanwhile, the U.S. military built pier in Gaza now unloading humanitarian aid again after being removed for a second time last week because of rough seas. The $230 million pier was meant to deliver humanitarian aid into Gaza via the UN's World Food Program. It has faced a number of setbacks.
Now, President Joe Biden, who is in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware today, had no public events on his schedule. He's headed to Camp David this evening. And then just a week from today, just 7 days from today, the big televised debate taking place between former President Donald Trump and President Biden. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Well, as Israel's war with Hamas rages on, civilians are paying the price. Over 3 million people in Gaza and the West Bank are in need of humanitarian aid. All right, let's bring in Abir Atifa for more. She is a senior spokeswoman for the World Food Program. Abir, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it. Tell us about the situation in Gaza and what you're seeing. What are the conditions like?
Well, you know, Tracy, it's been 8 months since this war has all started. The level of destruction in Gaza is really unprecedented. And the there is a massive public health crisis that's looming because of the scarcity of clean water, medical supplies, the level of hunger, malnutrition. There is limited food, fuel. So it's a very difficult situation.
Yeah, and I know that your organization has been in the area prior to the war. Can you kind of compare and contrast what the situation was before the war started and what it's like now?
Well, before the war started, the World Food Program was working on providing food assistance to around 300,000 people. But it was mainly more in terms of, like, you know, cash assistance, helping farmers, like, grow more food supplies. It was the kind of work that we call safety nets. It's something that helps people cope with poverty. But Gaza was, despite everything, was a vibrant place. And I have been there many times before the, you know, the 7th of October. Today, we have the whole population in need of food assistance. Markets completely collapsed. The infrastructure is gone.
What are the biggest needs right now? I know there are many.
Well, there are so many needs, but most importantly, it's the health situation. There is a need for fresh water, clean water supplies, medical supplies, proper food, because most of the people have been surviving on bread, on maybe canned food if they are lucky. That's, you know, that you can survive on this for a month or two or three, but for 8 months to survive without any fresh food, it does take a toll on your health, on nutrition status. And, you know, this is the baseline of a defense system for against diseases, you know, immunity and all of that.
Abir, do you coordinate with either Israel or Hamas when it comes to delivering aid into the region?
In any conflict, you have to coordinate with people on the ground. We are in coordination on daily basis with the Israeli Defense Forces because they are on the ground in Gaza. There are coordination with community leaders where we try to ensure that the roads are secure so that we can pass from one area to the other.
Abir, also, Israel has said that Hamas is part of the problem here with the aid, that they are taking the food from the people. What would you say to that? What have you seen?
Our food is getting to the people who need it the most. But if you are, if people are too hungry for too long, of course, like, you know, the situation becomes chaotic. And here I'm talking about, you know, civilians who are running behind the trucks, who are jumping because they lost faith that assistance is coming to them, that food is coming to them. You know, it's a father who's running behind this truck because he doesn't know if he will be able to go to the distribution point and have something left for his family.
Quickly, before I let you go, a dangerous situation all around for everyone there, also for your aid workers. Do they feel they're safe?
No one is safe in Gaza. And of course, our aid workers and the World Food Program staff are always on the ground. And whenever you are in an active conflict, it is a dangerous place, but it's particularly dangerous in Gaza.
Abir Atifa, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the White House also announced today that it will rush delivery of air defense interceptors to Ukraine, calling it a difficult but necessary decision. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby confirmed the U.S. will delay missile deliveries to other countries so it can fast-track orders to Ukraine. Kirby went on to say that Ukraine urgently needs the weapons to bolster its air defenses. Russian President Vladimir Putin is strengthening his country's ties with Vietnam. In an official state visit, Putin signed a handful of deals with Vietnam's president. Russia is offering to supply fossil fuels, including natural gas, to the Asian nation. The two leaders also agreed to cooperate in education, oil and gas exploration, and more. A handful of other agreements were signed, though details have not yet been made public. With the November election on the horizon, the stark contrast between Republicans and Democrats over pro-life legislation intensifies on Capitol Hill. This week, several Republican senators took to the floor attempting to pass a number of bills to protect the lives of the unborn, but were quickly blocked by Democrats. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales reports.
Good evening, Tracy. Monday will mark the two-year anniversary of the overturning of Roe, the day when the U.S. Supreme Court sent the abortion issue back to each individual state. Senate Republicans used the date to head to the floor. They wanted to debate their Democratic colleagues on when is a child a child.
Because they didn't want to see fewer abortions in America. They want to see as many or more. So the Biden administration opened up for the first time VA hospitals to provide abortions, even late-term abortions.
To giving IVF protections to couples wanting to start a family.
We want to empower childbearing generations so that families can address fertility concerns in a cost-effective manner. This bill is separate and complementary to IVF.
To protecting the unborn from botched abortions.
And so I suspect that Democrats are afraid that recognizing the humanity of a living, breathing, born child in an abortion clinic might end up leading to protection for unborn children.
Meanwhile, Democrats are seeking to overhaul an 1873 federal law that bans abortion-related materials, including abortion pills, from being sent through the mail. They're worried that a future Trump administration could invoke the Comstock Act to crack down on abortion access. So Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said the next vote, likely in July, would reestablish a national right to an abortion before the third trimester of pregnancy by codifying Roe.
We're telling our Republican colleagues, you cannot run away from the truth. Your record on women's health care is outright abysmal, shameful, and out of step with most Americans.
The women of this country should have the freedom to make our own decisions about our own health, our lives, and our futures. And we're not going to give up until we have those freedoms fully protected.
The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops says the church teaches us to respect and protect life absolutely from the moment of conception. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Well, the Supreme Court has upheld a tax on foreign income in a 7-2 decision. The nation's highest court kept in place part of a tax law passed in 2017 during the Trump administration. The law includes a one-time tax on U.S. shareholder earnings from some foreign companies. They ruled against a couple who brought the case after receiving a tax bill of more than $14,000 regarding an investment in India. At least three people are dead as Tropical Storm Alberto makes landfall in Mexico and brings heavy rain to parts of Texas. Roadways and parking lots disappeared in Corpus Christi amid 3 feet of storm surge. The storm weakened as it made landfall over Mexico. This is the season's first named storm. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including the church around the world. Colin Flynn speaks with a Kenyan archbishop about conditions for the faithful in the African country. Also in Kenya, police clash with protesters regarding a new finance bill. Welcome back. Some worrying developments for the pro-life movement in Spain. Lawmakers are considering a measure to extend assisted suicide to people with mental illness. This as the country's constitutional court rules in favor of abortions for minors without parental permission. In addition, the court eliminated a 3-day waiting period after an initial appointment for an abortion. And in Canada, a Catholic hospital is facing a lawsuit for not offering assisted suicide. The family of a terminally ill woman says St. Peter's Hospital in Vancouver should not have a religious exemption regarding euthanasia. The woman was transferred to a different hospital to be euthanized. Well, tomorrow night, EWTN News in Depth is taking a special look at the Catholic Church in Kenya. But tonight, we have a preview as Colin Flynn sits down with the Archbishop of Kisumu to discuss a major issue regarding marriage.
Polygamy is a serious challenge. Polygamy is a serious challenge to the sacrament of marriage.
Is it still widely practiced here?
To a certain extent, yes. To an extent, yes. So much so that in the Archdiocese of Kisumu, for example, we have had to form a group called St. Monica Widows. St. Monica Widows is supposed to look and take care of those ladies, women, who have lost their husbands. Because the other option is they are inherited culturally by somebody else. Inheritance.
You mean like a brother of the man who has died,
yes,
or a cousin would take them as a wife,
wife? It's a cultural issue. More and more ladies are opting to join this particular group and refuse to be inherited or follow the cultural practices of
It must be
community.
Difficult going against cultural norms, especially in small, rural, tribal areas.
It is a very big challenge. Some of them are ostracized by their communities because of this. Some are rejected. Some lose all their inheritance because of that. They have no access to the property left behind by the husband. But some are quite courageous.
And I know it's a very complicated and complex, but at the root of polygamy here, is it a sign of wealth and power that a man would have multiple wives because he can provide for them, or is it to have as many children as possible? Or
initially, there used to be a lot of high mortality, okay, in the community. So a person tried to respond to that particular situation by having one or two wives to himself. Some of them, of course, were rich and wealthy, so it was easy to explain why they're having one or two or three wives.
And if someone is in a polygamous relationship with a number of wives and they want to convert to the Catholic Church, What happens in that situation? Because the man has a responsibility now to a number of people and children he has to provide. How does the church handle that situation?
Actually, it has happened in many ways, many times. The one who is a second wife steps aside, continues her life, but has no matrimonial and conjugal relationships with the husband, okay? But he continues looking after the family because there are responsibilities. There are children in the family. He has to look after them. He continues to provide for the family, but the personal relationship between himself and the lady is not there. Now, he lives only with the first wife. And so the three can come back to the sacraments, but the man comes back to the original wife.
In the eyes of the church, she was the legitimate first
wife. That's right.
The first marriage stands.
That's right, yeah.
But is it difficult for the other women then if they want to come out of that relationship because they are then tainted in the village or the community? Would they be able to go on and marry again? Are they destitute to be on their own then?
In many cases, for example, many of these people already have many children. So the possibility of getting married again is slimmer.
Slimmer, okay.
Yeah, it's more. What happens more in most of the cases is find a way of providing for them.
So the church encourages them, look, you have a responsibility to provide for this.
That's right.
Person who is
I
in your
the,
life.
It's the least they can do because you can't abandon them.
Yes.
The children are his, and he once loved this lady. Mm. Okay, can't just treat her as if there was completely nothing. They want to go to their spiritual life, but they must remain human. That's right.
Did you come from an urban area or a rural area?
Myself, where I was born?
Yes.
Rural area.
Rural area?
Yes.
In terms of polygamy, was that practiced in your own family or in your...
In my family, yes.
Oh, in your family too?
Yes.
Did your
My father was a polygamist.
Your father was?
Yes.
How many wives did he have?
Two.
Yes. And were you from the first wife or the second?
The first.
The first wife,
that's
yeah.
Right.
What was that like?
My mother was a Catholic.
Your mother was a Catholic?
My stepmother was a Protestant.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your mother as a Catholic, how did she accept it? Just because it was so culturally the norm that she didn't...
She continued her faith.
She continued her faith.
It didn't stop her, especially from accessing the sacraments. Mm. And that's why all of us were baptized in the Catholic Church. Mm. Yeah, she brought us up in the Catholic faith.
And your memories growing up in that environment, you had happy memories growing up. It wasn't ever a problem.
It wasn't. Yeah, of course, there are challenges. Life is not normal, okay? But we did not encounter huge obstacles, but it could have been better. And the best is one man, one wife. That is the best.
And you can see more of that interview tomorrow night on EWTN News in Depth. Also in Kenya, chaos on the streets of Nairobi's business district as police clash with protesters. Horse riding riot police used tear gas canisters and water cannons as demonstrators advanced toward parliament buildings. At issue are the president's proposed tax hikes in a finance bill. Protesters are demanding lawmakers vote against the legislation. They say the president has gone back on his pledge to cut taxes and lower the price of living.
We are not going to sit at home so that they are going to pass another finance bill without our approval. We are going to add our voice to this, and we need them to understand that we are not okaying what they want to force on us.
Because an illiterate people will not question the government. And since we are literate, we are here to question the government. Cut on your expenditure. Do not overtax us. That's the laziest way for the government to earn revenue, overtaxation.
Now, the government has defended the proposed tax hikes, saying it was necessary to reduce the country's national debt of nearly $80 billion. The vote on the legislation is expected next week. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, the real presence of Christ. A new study shows what the faithful believe about the Eucharist, and the results just may surprise you. Plus, the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage visits Hansville, Alabama. We take you there. We'll be right back. reveals some eye-opening numbers on the faithful and their attitude on the true presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Vinier research found that 69% of Mass-attending Catholics believe in the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. The study was conducted in 2022, and its findings differ greatly from the much-discussed Pew Research poll from 2019 that found only one-third of Mass-going Catholics in the U.S. believed in the true presence of Christ in the Eucharist. And for analysis, we turn now to Hans Plate, founder and president of Vinier Research. Hans, great to be with you. So let's talk a little bit more about this. Why did your study come up with such different findings from those of Pew Research? And what about the difference in the language that you use as opposed to the questions from Pew?
Yeah, I think the findings were different principally because of the language. So there were two major changes we made to Pew's wording of the question. The first is their framing of the question was around the bread and wine actually becoming the body and blood of Jesus. And if you read what the Catechism teaches, what the USECB and the bishops, how they teach on the subject, they're often using the phrase real presence or truly present. And so that's one of the major changes we made. We use the phrase truly present as opposed to actually becomes, because I think it's language that Catholics are more familiar with and certainly language that the church proper uses. The other major change we made was in the response options that respondents were given to choose from. So you could either select that you believe that it actually becomes the body and blood or that it was a symbol. And technically, both are actually true, right? So it is a symbol, though it's not merely a symbol. And so we wanted to be clearer in that distinction. So our symbol option, as it were, was that it was a symbol, but it was Jesus is definitely not present in the body and blood. And so now we're mutually exclusive, and now we're, you know, it's a little bit clearer for respondents which one to select.
Yeah, language really does make a difference. Yeah. I know your study also broke down the belief in the true presence based on how often people attend Mass. Talk to us more about those findings.
Yes. Well, what was probably not surprising is that among those who go to Mass more often, their belief in the real presence is much higher. So I think among those who go to Mass weekly or more often, it's a little over 80%. What was surprising to me is if you look at the two groups of Catholics that go to Mass very infrequently, so those who go once or twice a year, their belief in the real presence, you know, 51% of them believe in the real presence. About two-thirds of those who go to Mass infrequently, so less than once a month, also believe in the real presence. And that's, you know, what is the depth of belief in the real presence? Because they say they believe it, but they're not going to Mass, right? And so that's, I think, a limitation of asking a question on a nuanced topic like Eucharistic belief on the basis of two simple questions. I think what's lacking is understanding the depth of that belief in order to really understand what people think about the transubstantiation and the real presence.
Yeah, and before I let you go, you know, why did you all decide to do the study in the first place? I understand it wasn't part of the official National Eucharistic Revival. So what sparked you to do this study?
Well, so there was a lot of buzz around this study, the Pew study, when it came out in 2019. And we obviously, you know, are very attuned to anything that comes out from secular polling organizations on Catholic beliefs. And what struck us right away was that the language just seemed unfamiliar to us. And so we wanted to do an experiment to see, is it just my discomfort with the language or is, you know, did that actually drive the difference? And so it was really just curiosity and wanting to understand the topic a little bit better to see what, well, you know, what Catholics really believe about the real presence.
And what's next for Vinier Research? And what would you like people to know a little bit more maybe about this study? Where can they access this information?
Sure, sure. So the report you can find on our website, viniaresearch.com, V-I-N-E-A, and there's a report tab where you can access this report and a couple of other reports. A lot of the work we do is for apostolates, so those are private reports and aren't part of, you know, what we share publicly. But the next study we're working on is around the kerygma, the extent to which Catholics believe the different components that go into the kerygma. So belief in God, belief in Satan, the sacraments, evangelization, all of that. And so we're working with a couple of other partners on that study and hope to have that available probably in the fall sometime.
All right. Looking forward to that. Hans, thank you so much for coming on today. We really appreciate it. God bless.
Thanks, Tracy. God bless.
Well, finally tonight, the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage makes its way through Hattiesville, Alabama, burial site of EWTN foundress Mother Angelica.
O Salutaris Hostia.
The day included a Eucharistic healing service, which included a reflection on shame and how it helps us to recognize good from evil. There was also a reminder to not believe the lies of the devil. The shrine was filled beyond capacity. The visit to Hansville was part of the Juan Diego route of the National Eucharistic Procession. And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.